TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva, Biopiracy versus the Peasants of India. Vandana Shiva is a physicist, philosopher of science, feminist, and campaigner against globalization, the patenting and ownership of life, and the WTO. She is an internationally acclaimed speaker and author, and uses her growing influence to champion the cause of the poor in India. The University of San Francisco had invited her to give a lecture on biopiracy. The auditorium was filled to capacity, and she was given a very formal introduction by a faculty member who said she was a cross between Einstein and Gandhi. When Vandana Shiva took the stage, as always, without any written notes, the air of formality dispersed right away. The urban audience and university faculty were immediately taken on a journey to the small farms of India. And there, in the middle of rice paddies, vegetable gardens, and shrimp farms, where once mangrove forests stood, the heavy hand of global corporations and the WTO became apparent more than we even fear to experience them in the industrialized countries. At the end of the lecture, Vandana Shiva had made connections to genetically modified foods, biopiracy, and the role of industrial agriculture in climate change. Here is Vandana Shiva.
When I was asked to come and give a talk on biopiracy, around that time, I had received in the mail this amazing package. It says, Holding the Earth. And one would imagine it's an environmental group. I don't know if any of you recognize a shade of a logo. It's Monsanto. It's amazing because it's 50 years in agriculture. One would, by reading it, think that if Monsanto hadn't been around selling herbicides, there'd have been no food in India. But the one I love is this page with a true story with a happy ending. And they're two sick farmers. And below them it says, chor, chor, thief, thief. And they're not talking about the farmers at that point. They would today if they were saving seed. They're talking about the biodiversity in the field, about mixed farming, about the greens that feed our rural people, our cows, our cattle, provide medicine. Our studies show that an ordinary small farm in India has at least 200 to 300 species, including those that are not planted, but are intended to be there, like the bathwa that grows with the wheat. My grandmother used to cook wonderful bathwa ka saag. It's the richest source of iron and vitamin A. The little Philanthus niruri, called the Jaramla, major cure for jaundice. The bathwa was declared a thief by Monsanto, and they then go on in the next page talking about the brilliant ways in which they have actually helped an environmental revolution in India. On Roundup, more than a herbicide, it represents a movement that has changed cultivation forever. A broad-spectrum herbicide for sustainable development in line with environmental-friendly technologies. Roundup is marketed now in India in a very aggressive way as conservation tillage. Now, if I hadn't worked with the small-scale farms where at every point in every season you have cover crops, we have rains that come in 3 months, 4,000 millimeters, 3,000 millimeters, strong summer sun, 50 degrees. If you really followed the Monsanto prescription of having rows of soybean or corn with herbicide resistance built into them, Roundup being sprayed to wipe out everything, it's not going to conserve the soil. Just the opposite of conservation tillage. It's an erosion package. It's an erosion of biodiversity, the deliberate extinction of the plants that people need to feed themselves. It's a deliberate creation of erosion of soil and water capital. And yet, because of this amazing magic of the way mathematics has worked in agriculture, we're all made to believe that each time we destroy our food sources, we are producing more food. One reason I've stayed busy with looking at agriculture for the last 16 years now, starting with 1984, when this region of Punjab, it was supposed to have benefited from the Green Revolution. It was the place for the miracle. The Green Revolution was introduced as an alternative to the Red Revolution that was happening in China. All the money had to move to prevent India going the China way. And in spite of those millions being poured by the World Bank for subsidies for chemicals, millions being poured by the Rockefeller Foundation, in the late 70s, early 80s, Punjab was up in arms with discontent, frustration, basically talking about being ripped off by an agricultural system that was leaving them poorer by making them dependent on inputs that they didn't produce, on prices they didn't have any influence on. I made my most recent trip to Punjab about 2 months ago to a region called Bhatinda, very, very prosperous region it used to be. Today, every village is deeply indebted. Every village I visited had had one or two suicides. And this is just one other area, Warangal in Andhra Pradesh, more than 500 suicides in the last 2 years. Yotmal, Maharashtra, also suicides. Why has it got aggravated in the last few years? Because in addition to all the burdens, environmental burdens, financial burdens that were put on the farmers, in the last few years, because of trade liberalization, because of the new economic policy of 1991, triggered by the conditionalities of the World Bank and IMF, and more recently the free trade rules imposed by the World Trade Organization, we basically have a free market in seeds, pesticides, chemicals, lending. It's like through the chemical agriculture, farmers are put on crutches. They're made dependent. And instantaneously, rather than let the person who's been walking with crutches remember how to walk again through ecological internal input farming, which is very doable. You give farmers 2 years, they will convert. But you pull the crutches instantaneously, the farmers fall. And that is what the real intention about these very brutal structural adjustment reforms are, to let the small producers fall and allow agriculture to move into the hands of global agribusiness. I've talked to farmers in regions where suicides started, and I said, why did you buy that seed? They said, the video was so good. Now, you know, it isn't Indian farmers alone who go after the videos. After all, that's how all the consumerism in this society works. You know, videos are very convincing. If we did not have scarcity of seed, we would not have a market in seed. If every farmer was saving seed every year, where would you have a seed market? You would have seed abundance, but no seed market. So you have to create seed scarcity. You have to engineer seed so that it is sterile, so that farmers are forced to come back. You have to create hybrids so that farmers are forced to come back to buy seed every year. And if you're a chemical company that has bought up seed companies, which is the case for most biotech companies, they were basically chemical companies which expanded in the 80s to take over seed companies, and are basically finding very, very efficient ways to hook their chemical sales to their seed sales. 87% of biotech applications are herbicide-resistant crops. That's also the kind of acreage under GE crops. Now, herbicide-resistant crops do not increase food production. They decrease food production. One thing that has now been established by all the research that has been done on biotech crops and biotech foods is that very false assumption that was put into the U.S. regulatory system of substantial equivalence, that genetically engineered crops are identical to their natural counterparts, does not hold. The BT in the bacteria is very different from the BT in the plants. That is why, even though the natural BT does not go around killing monarch butterflies, BT, corn, pollen does. Ordinary cotton does not kill ladybird beetles, but BT crops do. And this change in the structure of your, the physiology of the plant, the biochemistry of your plants, is part of what that modification is about. And since the genetic engineers, when they're thinking of engineering plants to produce their own pesticide, they forget that that plant is also supposed to be a food, not just for humans, but for the entire food chain, for the entire web of life. They're only thinking of that one pest that needs to be knocked out with the most toxic chemical that you can build into plants. But that's exactly what the thinking was behind pesticides. And pesticides did not solve the pest problem. It created a pest problem. We now have analysis of pest occurrence in indigenous crop varieties and pest occurrence in introduced crop varieties. And of course, farmers who do what they should be doing, which is saving seed, are pirates under the new intellectual property rights systems. And as if it was just seed and biodiversity and plants where this was working, the latest is privatization of water, being propelled on the one side by the World Bank, requiring privatization, and on the other side by the World Trade Organization, wanting to define free trade in water as a free trade in an environmental service. But the most important point is we now know enough about the mythology of the high productivity of monoculture industrial systems. These are impoverished systems. They cannot feed the world. They are systems that starve species. They kill the soil organisms. One of the experiments we do with farmers when we are encouraging them to convert is, you know, just take the urea that is applied in huge quantities on soils, get earthworms, and sprinkle urea on them. They die right in front of you. After a farmer has seen that happen in front of her eyes or his eyes, they will never, ever touch these synthetic fertilizers again. Because while the chemicals and the genetically engineered crops feed the profits, they do not feed the soil. They do not feed the species. And they do not feed the large majority of poor. Very often people feel that just because in the richer countries the supermarkets are more loaded than ever before, there's surplus around the world. It's not true. It's possible to have huge stocks here of shrimp of every kind, because every coastal system of every country is being converted into a shrimp farm so that cheap shrimp can arrive in Japan, Europe, and the United States. But every kilogram of shrimp that is arriving here is depriving local communities of thousands of kilograms of fish and food. Every acre of a shrimp farm is ruining and devastating permanently 200 acres of productive mangroves, of creeks, of coastal waters. Because 15 times more fish has to be caught at sea to feed the shrimp in the factory farms. And the factory farms, since they're stocked with saline water, have this seepage. And in Tamil Nadu, in Andhra Pradesh, in Orissa, the entire coastal area now has water scarcity because there's salt water and women are having to walk 10 miles, 20 miles, which is why they started actions. We built a movement. We had a Supreme Court case. We got the activity stopped. And yet, because we are in this deregulated environment, the shrimp trading interests financed by the World Bank are basically thinking they will undo the laws on the basis of which we closed the shrimp industry. And that, for the last 3 years, has been a big tug of war. Will they get away moving parliament to change the laws, or will we use our parliament to prevent the changing of those laws and deregulating the environment totally for free trade in shrimp? You might have heard of the recent cyclone in Orissa in November. It killed 35,000 people. We've just finished a study. The cyclone was twice the velocity of all cyclones in the past. It was 300 kilometers. The tidal wave came in 30 kilometers. Past memory, people say 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, you get flood waters coming in. It came in 30 kilometers. And the velocity was higher and was not reduced because in the regions where the shrimp farms have come up, the mangroves, which are the buffer, have been destroyed. Where the mangroves survived, the damage was much less. The figures from the Danish Environment Ministry are that for a kilogram of food moving around the world, 10 kilograms of CO2 is being pumped into the atmosphere. And all that CO2 is what is creating the climate change. And we live in such a scientific world that instead of recognizing climate change as an environmental catastrophe that is happening around us, all our climatologists are kept busy finding new names for these occurrences. Yeah? It's El Nino and La Nina and Elena and, you know, it just goes on and on. El Nino was supposed to happen once in 7 years. Somewhere or the other, there's an El Nino every year. And this individual naming is part of the mystification so that people don't recognize that you cannot destroy food production systems and local economies everywhere and ship every grain of food eaten and every bit of water drunk around the world and expect the climate to stay absolutely stable. Climate change is just one of the externalities of a free trade, globalized industrial agriculture system that is creating absolute threats to the very survival of people. The figures for India are scary. We will, if nothing is done, as a result of the global CO2 accumulation, India is going to have, within the next 50 to 80 years, 50 million people dying along our coastal regions because of these kind of storms, 75% decline in precipitation and runoff, which means 75% increase to the existing water scarcity, which for Monsanto will be wonderful because they're saying, as water gets scarce, our sustainability analysis tells us that there's a sustainable market in water. That is their sustainability reason for wanting to enter private markets in water. In addition to all this is, of course, the attempt to not just own living resources that people need for survival, but to declare them an invention. You've heard of the case of basmati rice, the rice that grows in our Dehradun Valley. RiceTech insists it invented basmati instantaneously. Even God took 7 days. And all these traits, no matter how they occur in anyone's plants, will be treated as an infringement. And there are enough legal cases in this country that have basically said that if a company has a patent on a plant trait, it doesn't matter how that patent came to be. It could be through traditional crops. It could be through farmers breeding. The existence of it will be treated as an infringement. It will be treated as piracy. That is the reason that there is so much pressure on India to change her intellectual property rights laws. From 1993, there have been 7 attempts to change our to introduce plant variety monopolies and to change our patent laws. So far, we have managed to stall it each time. Last November, the company started to get desperate, and GlaxoWelcome put pressure on Europe and the US to say, we want exclusive marketing rights based on patents we hold anywhere else in the world. Because we have an AIDS drug we want to sell, but we will only sell it with an exclusive right to market. And we hope the courts will rule that this is absolutely against the constitutional rights of the Indian people to have access to medicine and access to healthcare and access to nutrition and access to seed. But the really interesting thing about the piracy issue is that even though it is now recognized not as an aberration, It is recognized as an epidemic that is systemic. It is a perversion of the system of intellectual property rights. It's a perversion of a system of patenting that actually makes the basic mistake of imagining that living resources, life forms, are inventions that can be owned as property. Because no matter how much brilliance you have in moving genes around, you're just a gene mover. You're not a life maker. It's like taking chairs from this hall and putting them in a building across the street, and there's no way the University of San Francisco could tell the owners of those houses that just because we moved a chair, we own your house, we made it. Never get away with it. We don't get away with it in real estate, but we get away with it on the very fabric of life. That moving genes is treated as making life. And then the right of exclusive right granted by through the patent system to exclude everyone else from making life creates this amazing worldview where nature making life is treated as a pirate. Farmers working with nature to produce life are treated as pirates. And the pirates are protected by the world intellectual property rights system. If you just put together the ads that come out in this, you know, in the world today, there are no people. There are no people with rights. There are, of course, no species. The only institution that has rights are the corporations. And the only entity that is creating life is capital. And that to capital in a totally disembodied, totally uprooted form. 70 to 80 times out of proportion with the goods and services on this planet. And the goods and services are actually shrinking as the ecological crisis shrinks our water, as Monsanto helps us wipe out our biodiversity on our farms. And that is why we have a double level response to this enclosure of life, the commons, knowledge, cultures, and enclosure of the future too. Because while we've had colonization before, while we've had globalization before, what is unique about the contemporary globalization is that it works with technological tools that do not just colonize nature and other cultures, it is colonizing the future itself. It is destroying the evolutionary potential through the contamination of the web of life, through genetic pollution, biopollution. That is why the debate on genetic engineering becomes deeper the more people hear about what's going on and what the consequences are. It's also a colonizing of the future in terms of how many people are being robbed of their right to survive and live on this planet with dignity. Our campaigns to change this include the call that agriculture and food needs to come out of a free trade regime. Food is not about trade and profits alone. Food is about nourishment. Food is about our obligation to the earth. Feeding every species is the duty of humanity. Eating yourself is a byproduct of feeding others. And that is how we have managed to ensure food security, through sharing, through giving. That sharing and giving is today a criminal act under the rules of free trade. We have to reclaim our freedom to save seed, to share food, to give food. And we have to criminalize the activities that are criminalizing life itself. Getting food out of the WTO, getting biodiversity out of intellectual property rights, those are two minimal steps in which we need a worldwide movement of people, no matter where they work, whether they work with farmers and agriculture, whether they work in ethics, culture, traditions. They work on consumer rights. They work on human rights. No matter where you are, if you are living today, the obligation to the present and to the future requires engagement in these issues. We also have fun along the way. We have a campaign that sends out, you know, we have a campaign, a movement for reclaiming living democracy, not just for the human community, but for the earth community. And village after village, people are taking a pledge. More than 3,500 villages in India have already formed their biodiversity republics called Jaiv Panchayat. And through that, they basically say, all the diverse life forms are our brothers and sisters. We have to look after them. We will use them sustainably. We will recognize the gift of our ancestors in transferring knowledge that allows us to know how to use them for food and medicine. And we will resist all piracy and patenting of our rich biodiversity. We will produce food and medicine in ways that everyone can be fed and everyone can have health. And we will not obey patent laws that prevent this from happening. We will not allow GM crops into our regions because they are a threat to our biodiversity and our survival. And we will make our regions toxic-free and chemical-free. Now, you know, I might talk in a certain place and this some villager will be there, and then the next time you're traveling down a remote area of Garhwal and you see on the wall, this is a GE-free, a GM-free, patent-free, chemical-free zone. And while we work to get liberation of food and life forms from the international trade treaties, I think part of what we can do everywhere is to literally work wherever we are to create that new freedom, a new inclusive freedom that includes all species, includes all people, transcending and transforming the exclusions based on gender, caste, class, religion. And that new freedom initiative, that new freedom enterprise is something that is possible everywhere, even in the heartland of Silicon Valley. And it would be wonderful to start seeing in California a movement grow of a California that is GE-free, patent-free, chemical-free. Now, once California becomes that way, can you imagine how much we'll be saved around the world? So join us in our initiatives and give us a little help. Thank you.
That was Vandana Shiva. She's a physicist, feminist, and one of the most eloquent activists against biotechnology and the plunder of the so-called green gold, the biological heritage of the Third World. She heads the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi and is science advisor for the Third World Network Malaysia. She wrote several books, among them Monoculture of the Mind, Biotechnology and the Environment, and Biopiracy, the Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. This was a carefully selected half-hour segment of a one-hour talk at the University of San Francisco. TUC Radio is listener-supported, and you can get this one-hour tape for $12. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilarden. Thank you for listening.